All right. Well, we'll jump. We're gonna jump, babe. We're here. Woo!
Rumor spreading round in that Texas town about the shack outside the game. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls. I'm right there.
Everybody, welcome to Drive Through HR. Ryan, William, and Nisha coming to you live every day, talking HR with the people who love HR. So let's get to our guest because it's going to get real, and he's going to change some lives today. So, Liam, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Nisha. Hi, William. Thanks for having me.
If you would, let's kick it off. Have you introduce yourself to our Drive Through HR family, and then we'll jump right into what's top of mind and keep you up at night.
Sure. Okay, great. Thanks, Mike. Well, let's see. I've got a long Bavarian French name, Guillaume. I am French. At least I still have the passport. I haven't lived there in a very long time. I've been living in Bangalore, India, for the last 13 years, where I've been working in call centers and IT companies, and then creating my own consulting firm. And I've spent most of my life outside of France, including in the U.S., where you guys are sitting. And I think that's given me, that's broken me in some ways, given me some insights in another way. And hopefully I can draw on these today to do what I do.
Nice. What is, this is William, by the way. What is top of mind for you these days? What's keeping you up at night?
Okay. So apart from my daughter that's sick, which is keeping me at night, literally, at the moment is actually trying to find a way to actually do practical skill building regarding intercultural competence. I think that's today for me is really the next frontier regarding this particular field of work, which I've specialized in. I think a lot of these programs are very good as far as awareness is concerned. And there's a lot of different methods whether you're talking dimension-based, value-based, and so on. But I find them very lacking in practicality. And I think people get out of there, it's an interesting discussion, but how do I apply all this? And that's what I'm working on. I'm working with a tool called the Intercultural Development Inventory, which is a psychometric tool that was developed by Mitch Hammer about 15 years ago to try and assess where people stand in their intercultural sensitivity developmental process. I try to work with that and use that as a coaching tool to try and actually get some practical results.
You know what's funny is here in the States we have such a weird view on the skills gap, and it seems like every other day there's some new article talking about, you know, abundance or surplus or scarcity, et cetera. What's your take on, because you actually have kind of a global vista in which you can look at things. What do you think's really going on with the skills gap?
Okay. Well, funny you talk about it because I was actually on LinkedIn today discussing that quite heatedly with people from different corners of the globe. So the thing is, I don't think any education system can be perfect. Now, I think the purpose of the education system is to educate, and one aspect of this is employability, but I don't think it should be the only one. And I think that's something that recruiters, corporations, and talent development professionals need to keep in mind is that college is made to make you employable, but not only. That's not only a fraction of education, at least in my view. After that, every system is different. It will equip their students differently, and they'll arrive with different readiness as far as skill set is concerned. I think, in my experience, the French system is a system that values a lot of discussion, rational argument, and you have people after that have usually are well equipped with rational thinking, but sometimes lack in the, let's say, in the practical application sense of it, because the French education system doesn't really focus on that. And the other country where I've got experience, because I've been a student here as well as teaching in schools, and working with fresh graduates is India. And I think India, on the other hand, is in the education system, at least traditionally, has made very technically very sound people, but very often has had a lack of focus on soft skills, and which can impact the employability, at least in certain sectors of the economy. Everyone doesn't need to speak English fluently for what they do, but I think a certain amount of interpersonal skills is good for everybody's success, and I think a skill like language is a skill that's very important for the population working in the multinational industries, for example.
I want to ask a question about responsibility and skills, and I don't want to assume that it's up to the individual in terms of training and getting their skills from A to B, et cetera. Culturally, what do you see that's similar or different as it relates to this? Like, whose actual responsibility is it to build these skills? Is it the company? Mm-hmm. Is it the education system? Is it the family? Is it the individual? Like, where in different cultures does that scale, if you would, move from place to place?
So again, not familiar with every culture. I'll talk about the two I'm familiar with, which are France and India. The difference I see in the learners, especially in how they see who's responsible for that. I think in India, we see people take responsibility themselves for it. I find people very eager to learn and very often driven personally for it, whatever their objective might be, but I find people very driven to learn, much more than in France, where people expect the organization, if not the state, to take care of this. So I know it might sound like a caricature of the French, but it's a big difference I've seen. And so if I want to cut a long story short, it's just in India, people come and are eager to learn most of the time. It's not stereotype, but and in France, I find people come in the room and says, you need to convince me that I need to learn this. And I know that for me, who's in development, in talent development, that's a big difference. I enjoy working with both, but it's a big difference.
Hmm. What, in your research and kind of just in your life, skills training is great when the skills can be taught. So what are the edges of that? What skills can you, that you've kind of run up against that really can't be taught or they're harder to teach people?
Well, I don't think you can I think a lot of these skills stem from the fact that whether you care about others or not, I don't think that can be taught. You can't teach someone to care about others. I think once you care, after that, a lot of these skills will make sense to you, and you will want to build them because you actually care. For example, listening skill is not something that happens if you don't care about what the other person's got to say. Assertiveness is not something that can happen if you don't really care about trying to meet the other and try and meet their needs as well. So I think for me, caring is something that's very important, and that I think is at the basis of a lot of the interpersonal skills that are needed today to be effective. I think another one is self-esteem, probably has also an impact as far as executive presence or influencing is concerned, or even assertiveness as well. You can teach people some assertiveness communication skills, but I think there again, it stems in your head and how you see yourself and how you see others, and do you actually truly believe that everyone, including yourself, has the potential to add value to any group of human beings. And I think for me, that's where assertiveness is going to come, when you have that belief.
So let's say you're new to HR, and regardless of where you sit, country-wise, et cetera, but you're new and you know a little bit about skills training, skills development, et cetera, but you really haven't done a lot of it. There's so much of HR is experiential. Where do we, and I'm just assuming you do an inventory, then you figure out a plan to kind of get from people from A to B, and you work that into kind of what does your workforce look like now and what it should look like in the future. So there's an element of succession, or at least an idea of where the workforce is shifting. How do you suggest HR basically kind of, if they don't know skills development, skills training, et cetera, how should they go about getting that set up?
Well, I think the first thing is actually learning. It's a profession, and like any profession, I think it can be learned. So there's a lot of things to start with. I agree with you that a lot of it is going to be experiential, and you're going to learn by doing. But I think if you're really interested in getting into it, it's find people who know get them to mentor you and help you understand where you can, well, help you pass the first few hurdles. After that, you're going to have to trip and you're going to have to fall and you're going to have to make mistakes like everyone in order to be able to learn how to do it on your own successfully. But I think the first thing is seeing HR as a profession rather than a hobby. I think a lot of people, at least in my experience, when I was in the corporate world or even clients that I meet today, HR very often is seen as a hobby in the organization, where you put, and unfortunately it becomes the dumping yard of the organization very often because of that. And I think for young people who come in there and want to learn or are eager to do it well, that can be very damaging. But I think if they find the right people to mentor them, again, I'm sure they'll be able to learn the professional aspect of it and be able to see that. It's a very validated field to work in.
The delivery mechanisms of learning, and I'm thinking of some non-traditional stuff like Khan Academy or, you know, some of the vocation schools that are delivered through the Internet or even TEDx or TED videos, et cetera. What's been your experience with kind of your non-traditional delivery systems for learning?
Well, I try and incorporate them as much as possible. So I'm also in charge of HR and heads of development for my own firm. And so I'm going to talk more on this from this perspective. I know I've been implementing the concept of MOOCs as a professional development tool in the organization. We've set it up, we've introduced the staff to it because most of them were absolutely not aware of what it was. So we took them through the different platforms, showed them what was there, and then told them that we'll give them the time to do it. And that's our commitment to that's part of our commitment to their professional development. So that's, for example, one aspect of non-conventional that we've tried to apply to ourselves. For clients, there's more and more discussion about going mobile. So we're discussing this internally and probably seeing this as one of the next cycle of growth for us. Is taking learning mobile, so how do we complete what happens in the training room through the mobile interface? So whether it's going to be applications, SMS, or any other kind of application, we don't know yet. But that's really what we're thinking about.
What do you think about certification or testing at the end of training? Like, what's your belief, your kind of your take on, you know, okay, you've downloaded some content or we've taught you some content, et cetera, or maybe you've worked with, you know, particular learning for a while. Do you believe that folks should be tested to make sure that they got what you were delivering? Or what's your general take on testing?
Sure. So again, I don't think anything should happen or not. It depends what you want to achieve and how mission critical your skill development program is. I don't think every training program is mission critical. And the thing is, being able to assessments can be very useful in order to try and see a delta in behaviors before and after. I personally don't suggest to my clients to use tools just after without using it before. So doing it in a pre and post assessment. And also do them as 360 assessments. So instead of just self-rating, okay? And that I think there is some benefit to it because people see how they've altered the perception that their peers, their direct reports, or their supervisors might have or not, okay? And I think for the client, it's very reassuring because it gives them data, okay? So if we're going to talk to Kirkpatrick, being able to define behaviors before the program based on what we want to achieve before the delivery and then do that after the delivery 6, 9, 12 weeks afterwards is a good way to assess, to do a level 3 assessment in the Kirkpatrick model, for example. A lot of clients want that today, which I can understand as well. Okay, but I don't think it's too long to run, it's too much effort, and it's also expensive to do. For this to happen on every single program. That's why I'm saying I think it makes sense on mission-critical programs.
Should we
use it more and more often. We suggest it now in every proposal we make, we suggest this.
Nice. Should we know about learning styles and learning differences or difficulties? Like, you know, in order to deliver content, some say that it's kind of homogenized and you lose the edges of people that either have learning difficulties or learning differences, or they just stylistically they learn differently than what we're delivering. So they would love the content, but they just can't get the content because that's not how they learn. Like, what should we do to figure out all of those things before we deliver content?
Well, that's always a tricky one, except if you really have the time to, if you know your participants well because you've been working with them for a long time. But I think otherwise it's very hard. You don't know who you're going to have in the room. So I know that our approach is, well, since you don't know, think about all your kind of learners and try and just in your instructional design, try and think about that, okay, the way you develop your content. After that, you need to be able to be mindful enough in the room to try and see whether it works or not, and be able to stretch your style sometimes. If it's a style issue, I know that's something I believe in very strongly for that is co-facilitation, because I do see that difference in style sometimes works very well. I've got someone, for example, so... We're going to talk social styles. I'm someone who's a very strong expressive. And I know that sometimes it can be a bit too overwhelming for the more analytical ones in the room. And I know that when I co-facilitate with my business partner, who's very strong analytical, first of all, we work very well together. And I think for the participants, it provides a balance for the different styles in the room. And on top of that, it shows them that working from the opposite end of the spectrum actually can work, and we have fun doing it. So it's all win-win for that. So I actually believe in co-facilitation a lot for that as well.
Nice. So is it a case with all the different new types of mediums that we're able to deliver training with that maybe we just have to recalibrate our expectations on retention? And maybe it's more people just are accessing the information over and over again and retention levels change?
So I don't have data on this. I have my own intuition about this. I know that I'm still a bit skeptical about certain forms, how certain technology is going to help, apart from sheer repetition. But I know, and I'm pretty sure it's true for most of you too, when I keep receiving an SMS over and over and over and over again, I don't read it after some time. So I'm not sure the repetition is actually going to work. I'm also a strong believer in the power of sharing experiences. So I do think that community learning, learning in community, is still very important. Being able that can happen in a virtual environment, by the way. It doesn't always have to be in a classroom either. But I think having facilitated discussions for people to be able to share experiences and debrief them together, I think remains for me a very important part of learning that I'm not sure we've been able to recreate yet on the newest platforms, on mobile, for example, or even in MOOCs. I know that I've attended a couple of MOOCs. I would love to be able to have more direct discussions with the people attending, and I can't get it. So I know that's frustrating me as a learner. So yeah, that's my take on it. There again, I'm sure there's a lot of potential. I'm still not sure how I can tap into this personally. A lot of people are saying that they have. I'm still waiting to be convinced.
So I've got two different terms that I want to kind of get your take on or reaction. So crowdsourced learning is the first one, and social learning is the second one.
The two big words at the moment, aren't they? So by crowdfunding, I do think that can be – the concept in itself, I think it's fascinating. The whole concept of crowdfunding. Crowdfunding learning sounds really interesting. Now, there again, can we get a platform? And actually, it is already happening. I know that I spend a lot of time in forums with people who are in similar professions than I am, and we're already exchanging stuff. And that is, for me, already it is already crowdfunding, crowdsourcing in a certain way. Social learning, as I said, I'm still waiting to see. I'm waiting to see how it actually works. I've read a lot of people's experiences. I'm now doing it in my own organization. I want to see how it works. I've got a very diverse population in my office, even though there's not much of it, not many of us. I'm sorry, but I'm really keen to get their feedback, because I know my style of learning is very exchange driven. So I do enjoy having people around me. I realize that is a learning style, and not all of them. That's why I'm keen to hear most from first-hand feedback, which I'm hoping to get in the next few weeks. And I'll have a better opinion then.
Nice. Well, we'll have to have you back on the show for that. The role of the LMS, so I want to get your take on kind of structured content versus unstructured content. And like Brian's question, this is how do you capture the stuff at the that happens informally in the hallways, et cetera? Or do you capture it? Or should an LMS capture this type of content, et cetera? So just give us your take on what is the role of the LMS?
Okay. So I do think that now technology, and especially social media, is enabling us to recreate some of these corridor environments. I think in that sense, communication internally is a lot more informal because of social media and the internal social media platforms that most companies have today. So I think that's a big now, as far as what the LMS can do, again, I think it's always difficult to leave that completely to software. I do think that we're talking about something that's too fundamentally human to be only driven, yeah, like that. Yeah? So I think in that sense, social media is enabling us to recreate some of this. And I think it's important. So I know that I'm, for example, creating for certain key programs that are happening on for a long time, I am creating WhatsApp group, informal WhatsApp group, for example, with participants and different sponsors and stakeholders in trying to facilitate discussion there. And I see them interacting informally amongst them, and everyone does too. So I think that's something that's really helpful, I think. And I think that's a way to keep the ties between people happening and the discussion happening in the long term.
Nice. All right, I want to ask about how we, I'm assuming you're at least trilingual with French, Hindi, and English. So you've got to have a kind of a unique take on my question, and it's basically around cultural appropriateness or cultural awareness. So I'm assuming that in your travels, you've kind of probably failed at some stuff in terms of, understanding the culture or kind of what's going on or how things are being played out, et cetera. So how do we teach that? How do we teach that to our own workforces, and how should we go about delivering kind of training around what is appropriate, what is how one should be aware of other cultures, et cetera?
Well, I think it starts again with self-awareness and understanding that we have our own cultural identity as an individual, which a lot of people forget, and that's why they have a tendency to put very often people, okay, so because I'm culturally similar than people around me, I don't need to make that effort, I don't need to think about it. But I don't think we could be more wrong in this. I think cultural diversity starts with our neighbor, even with our brothers and sisters, to be honest, because none of us are exactly similar because we've had different experiences, we do different things, we have different jobs and different friends and stuff, so, which makes us culturally different. I think it starts with realizing what are the cultural aspects that I drive me to, which are my cultural identities. Yes, I'm Indian, but whether I'm a Punjabi or whether I'm a Tamilian is a very different thing. Whether I'm male or female, urban or rural, how does that impact me? How has that helped me shape the values that make me today? And then what are the behaviors that I, so if these are the values, are my behaviors in line with that? And then I can try and understand that. I think that process helps us understand that other people will be culturally diverse as well, and we'll have different values or similar values, and even if they're similar, might express them differently and so on. This is a developmental process. It doesn't happen overnight. There is no single training program that can help you do this. The only thing training can do is give you the awareness that these differences exist, okay, and that the intention most of the time is good. It's just that we misunderstand it. I think, for me, that's the key message of these kind of trainings, that suspend judgment. Because chances are the behavior you're facing you don't understand or that's frustrating you stems from this positive intention that you just don't understand. So try and understand what's driving the behavior of the person behind, rather than try and just stick to that gut reaction, that gut feel, that regular, knee-jerk reaction, because there's a behavior A or B that you just didn't appreciate, didn't understand, or that frustrated you. So changing experience is really important. I think that, again, it's being able to exchange experience to understand, first of all, it happens to everyone, and then being able to discuss it about, what was behind it.
Well, it's hard not to pull people out of being ethnocentric and seeing the world only through one lens, and again, like you said earlier, not seeing it from the other person's perspective, et cetera. You know, funny faux pas.
Everyone doesn't need to be an ethno-relative, by the way. The thing is, everyone doesn't need to, and I think we need to link that back to everyone doesn't need every skill. It's what is it that you want to achieve? And now, if you need to work with other cultures, then you're going to need to be able to move in that developmental process. But at the end of the day, you're living in a cave or you're living in a community in the middle of nowhere, and what you see is very much your very local environment. You might not even – why should you care? There's probably plenty of other skills that you need. I think it's very important to think of skill building depending on what you want to achieve.
All right, we got about 3 minutes left in the show. What's your funniest kind of faux pas or something that's gone on culturally that you've – a misfire where you thought X and you went Y or whatever? Funniest story.
You need another half hour, Brian. You need another half hour easily. okay, no, I think the biggest learning one, I'm not sure the biggest one. I'll tell you the funniest one afterwards. But the biggest one was when I actually lost my job because of a cultural misunderstanding. Because I left a room with my boss to go and meet a vendor because I was in charge of training vendors. And my boss took that as an offense, which it wasn't meant. For me, it was just our meeting was over at 4. I had another meeting at 4, so I told him, well, it's over. I got another meeting at 4. And he took that very personally. I now realize that. In the Indian context, it would mean something offensive. It wasn't my intention. None of us understood that at the point. Our relationship went down from there, and I actually had to leave the job a few weeks later. We ran into each other a few months later, and we get along very well now because we were both very frustrated at how we handled it. Otherwise, the funniest one was the day I stepped into Christ College in Bangalore, my first day in India, 13 years ago. I was coming to teach French. And I came, I had shorts, I had long hair down to my waist, had lots of beads around my neck, and I was stepping into a college that was held by fathers. And they looked at me, I thought their eyes were going to pop out their sockets when they realized I was going to be the new French teacher. So they asked me to cut my hair, take my beads off, and put pants on. So I said yes for the pants. I said no for the beads and the hair. And I could see they kind of half wanted to say, well, you're going to have to, otherwise it's not going to happen. Because I was doing all this for free because I was more than happy to come and teach French in India, they actually gave in and became known as the long hair French teacher all over Bangalore. That was fun.
Wow, well, those are two damn good examples. So, where can just last thing is where can folks connect up with you, and then we'll wrap it up and.
Everywhere on social media. Once you can type my name, once you've got my name, I'm easy to find because there's not that many of us. so I'm on Twitter. I think you've got given my Twitter handle. I also blog on WordPress. I've got a blog called French OD Consultant in India, Musings of a French OD Consultant in India, where I share a lot on my take on personal development, especially personal leadership, and also some aspects of strategic HR. And consulting. Otherwise, again, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Google. I'm on Google Plus. I think is it still called Google Plus? But anyway, yeah. I'm on the three main ones, which are Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and easy to find.
Perfect. Well, thank you for spending lunch with us. Great conversation, folks. We're out of here.